and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of One Perfect Game, the show about video games and the people who play them. My name is Matt Tilby. I am your host for this wonderful adventure. Now, my guest for this episode is a writer and performer who is currently gearing up for a bunch of big projects. Not only is her webcomic Longhead now in production for an animated series, but she is also now the art and narrative leads for a new indie studio called Toot Games, bringing out a new game in 2025. I am absolutely stoked to welcome Millie Holton to the show. Millie, welcome on in. How are you doing?
Oh, thank you so much for having me, and thank you for being so succinct with my intro.
I get that quite a bit from my guests coming in. They're very sort of taken aback by how, I guess, thorough my intros are. I feel like it's kind of my calling card now for the podcast. So
you're like Sean Evans on Hot Ones, but for intros specifically. I'm just, God, he's good at those.
I feel like that's like, you know, when people are like, oh, I wish I had the same amount of talent in my pinky as someone has in their entire body. Like that sort of thing. It's like that sort of comparison to Sean Evans. Like that's really cool, but like I am nowhere near the level of a Sean Evans interviewer. So I'll definitely take the intro compliment.
Well, how about this? Well, I only did the intro, not because I think you're bad at the rest of it. It's because we haven't done the rest of it. So exactly. if by the end I think you're at Sean Evans level, I promise I'll let you know. But take silence as a note as well.
Okay, good. At least I've got that as a barometer for the quality of the questions. But I mean, you've been super busy, it seems like. I've been able to sort of take a look at what you've been up to over the last sort of, I guess, about a year now, really. And it sort of starts with, you know, a huge congratulations for starting up Toot Games, the wonderful...
Oh, thank you so much.
Wonderful named Toot Games. And I guess especially the sort of the funding from VicScreen to help sort of drive the development of your first game entitled My Arms Are Longer Now. And I, like I'll say, I'm probably in the minority where I think the original name, which I think was Armed Robbery, was a much better name.
Oh, you can't do this, Matt. You can't do this. So this is the first thing you're kicking off with is bringing up a trauma.
I understand that the hoops you had to jump through to get that name changed were pretty significant. So I'm happy to leave it as is. But I mean, like, yeah, there's probably been a lot of logistical hurdles, and I mean, like, sort of, you know, job listings for sort of, I guess, expanding the team, even somewhat, you know, in a part-time or casual sort of situation. How has that sort of last year or so been sort of getting to grips with, I guess, yeah, running your own game studio?
Oh, it's been quite the learning curve. I'm from like film and TV and comedy land, and so dipping into game land was like pretty intense. My partner, who is also called Matt because that's the only name there is, has a much more of a game design programming background and used to work for EA Games, and he wanted to start a game studio. And you kind of need to assemble a team and all of that stuff. And I was like, well, I can write, I can draw, like, sure, like, sign me up. Something I've quickly learned is that, well, two things. First is that games take so much longer than any film or TV project that I've personally been a part of. I've only done so far web series and in development for other things that do take a longer time. But in practical sense, only web series, comics, etc., or Comfest shows or whatever. But games, oh my God, they take so long and everything takes forever and they're complicated. And so writing for games and doing art for games is so different to anything I've done. So initially it was a bit of a confidence hit, I will say, but slowly and steadily, like, finding my feet and now hiring people, which is crazy because I still feel like I'm learning so much. But yeah, that was a long answer, but it's been intense is what I would say, going from one industry and doing the other at the same time is pretty nuts.
Yeah, it definitely seems like there's been a lot on your plate. Obviously, you mentioned the web series for the one and only Longhead. I guess just this wild turn of events that's really sort of come about off what was essentially like a popular sort of... like comic, just that you'd been sort of doing. Like, how do you find, and I mean, as well, you also mentioned like your comedy festival appearances and other sort of like podcasts that you've done yourself. Like, are you someone who tends to put your eggs in a lot of baskets and really sort of keep your plans open? Because I feel like someone like me who had all of that sort of stuff happening at the same time, I would tend to struggle. I think I'm a sort of learner who is very much tunnel vision and sort of, you know, likes to keep himself sort of, I guess, level headed and sort of on one thing. Because if there's too much going on, I will definitely panic. So what was that like for you?
Great question. You've done so much research. This is a Sean Evans level. I'm letting you know. That I would say that I am much like you though, Matt, in that I get tunnel vision on things. And while I think there is like a lot of projects kind of or like eggs in different baskets at any one time, at least with how they've all kind of shaken out, it's very sporadic, the kind of intense work moments on them. So like for the Longhead web series, for example, like the voice recording for that was only a day, a year and a half ago in December. And then it was, you know, editing that over a few days, and then it kind of went to the animators, and I would give notes to the animators, but that was kind of only like a day a week, for example. And so when I'm not doing that day a week, then I can dip to like the game or to another web series or to like developing other things. So while it is like a lot of projects, when you look at it on paper, the workload is actually pretty spread out. And so I really like being able to be like, oh, today I'm doing this, and I can get tunnel vision on that, execute that. And the next day is like, oh, hell yeah, now it's this sort of a day. So it's very flattering that it's like, whoa, so much on, but I think it is a little deceptive. But I'll take the compliment.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a lot of, I guess it's good things that are happening all at once. So it's probably the positive of it. And I guess like, you know, bringing it back to the Longhead web series, like I'm going to read out the synopsis for anyone who doesn't really understand or has not heard of Longhead before. The synopsis that you'd presented to Screen Australia as well, I should say, that they're sort of, I guess, helping with the funding, I guess. Is that correct?
Yes, correct.
Okay. An animated sketch series following beloved, in quotes, character Longhead. If chaos is a ladder, Longhead walks under it, then drowns nearby in an inch of water. I'm lost for words at how just wild this is. Like, even reading up about the sort of the people that you've got on board with this, like Tom Walker and Sam Campbell coming on, like the producer, obviously Dan Illich, like this is pretty crazy for something that's, you basically were just like scribbling on it in your Instagram. Like, do you have to sort of like pinch yourself at these sorts of times being like, this is something that I was doing just as like a creative, you know, outlet. And now it's becoming something that's a little bit more fully fledged.
Oh my God, yes. Every day it's like, are you joking? This is crazy. Like, it was, I think, like part of the original appeal of like doing those Instagram comics. And then I'll like, I guess, hark back to the tunnel vision that you talked about. I got obsessed with doing those just Instagram comics. I was doing like 3 or 4 a week. They take about like 6 to 7 hours each. At least when I was getting started, I wasn't as confident of a drawer. And so I was just obsessed with this little guy. And truly, that was the only thing that kind of, you know, was, you know, the impetus to post them was just, oh, I really like this little guy. I'm going to keep drawing him.
Yeah.
And I think that enthusiasm was pretty contagious. And then I got started making figurines for him, I think 4 yes. comics in. Like, it was pretty insane. And I think it was the figurines that caught the attention of Dan, who cold emailed me, which is kind of the thing that you hear about, like, happening in like movies or something, of like, you just get this email and your life changes. And it was truly that, of like, Dan was kind of one of the first people, if not the first people, to like really put some trust in me creatively, and like, to be frank, pay me to do it, which is unheard of. And his email was something like, hey, really love Longhair, just wondering what your screen plans are for it. And in the back of my head, I'm like, what screen plans could this creature have? He's like, it's ridiculous. But I wrote back like, oh, yeah, got a few in mind. like, let's meet and chat about it. Playing it's so cool. Yeah, we met up and he was super keen to work together. I think, we got along really well. And then as we were kind of figuring out what to do next, we didn't have, like, the exact format in mind. He was tossing around like, so in dream scenario, who would you cast in this? And I was like, oh, look, if it's a dream and anything's possible, like, dream scenario would be, like, Sam Campbell, Tom Walker, and Kate Dennett. They're three comedians who I think are the funniest people in the world. Mm. And they all have the same, like, strange sensibility. And then Dan made it happen. And Sam Campbell was in, like, he's living in London. And we got him, like, pre-Taskmaster as well, which is crazy about. Yeah. Like, we couldn't get him now. Or maybe we could. I won't speak ill of him or assume what he would say yes to. But it's less likely that we would get him now. But this is like, yeah, pre-Taskmaster. Dan emailed me one day and he's like, Sam Campbell's in town for 3 days. Can you fly to Sydney tomorrow? And I was yes, I can. And so I fly up to Sydney and on the way, I'm assuming the whole time that Dan is going to be directing the episodes because the scripts are essentially comics that have already been done. So they've been, properly done. I fleshed them out a little bit more to bulk up the run time, but I kind of thought that I'd be kind of sitting in while Dan directed because he's been in this industry, 30 years or something crazy. And so I said to Dan, hey, like, how would you like me to, you know, chip in? If I have any ideas, do I just say them to you or something? He was like, Millie, you're directing them. And that kind of like set me into a spiral and I was so nervous for it, so nervous that I was like kind of hoping that it would be cancelled, you know, when you get that nervous for something. Like, even though it's a good thing, I'm like, I'm freaking out. But it went like as good as I could have hoped. Everyone was so lovely. I felt really comfortable once I was in there. Everyone was hilarious. And it was after we got those recordings that we went for Screen Oz funding, and I did not think we would get it at all because it's such a stupid series, but they really liked it. And yeah, that's the tale. I have to pinch myself every day. It's crazy.
Just like hearing that idea come to life in such a way that like you are literally jet setting to make it to recordings and directing sessions and things is very, it's a little bit mind blowing, to be honest.
I've never known anything of it since. was like the most like, I was like, I guess this is the industry. It's not the industry. but it was like a dream. It was like a haze of a dream. It was so cool.
Are you, I guess when you look back on it all and even like the genesis of Longhead, this little man with an extremely oblong forehead, like,
yeah.
Are you at all surprised at how much people have like opened their hearts to this freaky little man beyond compare?
Oh, that's a great question. In a way, yes, because it's such a thing just for me that I'm like, oh, what? How strange that other people could like this. But also, I'm so endeared to him. So on the other hand, of course, people are like, I'm in love. Why wouldn't you love this guy? I don't know what's the appeal of him. He's a tragic figure. I don't know. A tale of our time.
I was going to say like a cautionary tale. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, I couldn't tell you the exact appeal. I think like a third party would have to come in and articulate that. I think I'm too close to it.
I think it's just like, as you said, you're only like four comics deep when you're like, I'm going to make like full-blown figurines of the characters in this show. And like everyone snapped them up from what I heard. Like they went in like less than like 10 minutes. So, and that's just like absolutely wild.
Yeah, it was so surprising. It was people as well. Like, I expected like mum, dad, maybe a few friends, and then the others to sit like in my study for the rest of my life. But it was like people I didn't know. Mm. And so I'm still trying to like, wrap my head around strangers enjoying it. There's something about the head. I think it's like Kermit. He's got like a silhouette that is so simple, like Elmo. It's like that. Mickey Mouse.
Oh, man. I can't wait to see what happens with it, honestly. And I think we've got to get some of your art into into some stores in Brisbane, because I did see that some of it is in Melbourne and Sydney, which is great, but I think like Brisbaneites are a little bit starved for some long head action. So we'll have to see what we can do to make that work. But
oh, hell yeah. If there's any like, yeah, comic stores, especially indie bookstores, indie comic stores, then yeah, please let me know and I'll shoot them an email.
Yeah, I'll definitely have to look that one up for you. But we should move on, I guess, to the second part of the show, Millie, where normally where I get the guests to talk about their formative years in gaming. So whether that be the sort of first experience with a console or what they were playing as they grew up. So what was that like for you? Do you remember any sort of like formative experiences playing games, a first game, a first memory of something like that?
Yeah, so at my dad's house, we'd go to my dad's every second weekend, and he was a very early PlayStation adopter. He had the PlayStation 1, and so we were playing, you know, Crash Bandicoot, every like Naughty Dog game. I think Spyro was on there. Abe's Odyssey? I don't think we played that, but I remember, yeah, Dad was like going crazy on that. And we're very like competitive family as well. So it was either like watching Dad play, watching, I'm a twin brother, watching my brother play, or finally, when I'd get to it, having to go myself. And then eventually got the PlayStation 2, obsessed with that. And then, yeah, I'm loyal to Sony. Let's just say that. I refuse to budge to anything else. Yeah.
Okay. That is interesting, because normally like most of the people that I've spoken to have been sort of like, okay, I started with like, you know, PlayStation or a Nintendo, and then they sort of like moved to an Xbox or something and sort of like jumped between just purely from like convenience or what was available at the time. So it's interesting to see that someone has like stayed very loyal to a particular brand and that sort of like run of consoles they've had. So yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah, no, I'm stunted. I refuse to learn. And it's like, it's as simple as like the controller doesn't feel the same when I go to the Xbox. But yeah, my partner Matt has one and he's been trying to sell me on it. He's like, yeah, look at this Game Pass. You got so many free games. And I refuse. It feels weird. I don't want to touch it.
I mean, Game Pass is good value for money, but
I'm
I can
sure
totally...
it is. I've heard it all.
I'm not trying to sell you on it or anything. I'm just here to be an arbiter of all good things. So,
right.
But I think like, yeah, especially like that early sort of period for PlayStation, like as you said, like the Naughty Dog games, like the Crash original trilogy and Spyro.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I think that sort of, you know, mid to late 90s and maybe even early 2000s was like such a golden era for just very colorful, like jumping platforming sort of games like that. And I think we just don't get enough of them now. And that's the issue.
Gorgeous. Yeah. And I think, yeah, my dad was kind of the one leading the charge on those ones. But once we got to, you know, PlayStation 2 and maybe 3, I'm trying to remember what the time period wise, but it was definitely a case of going to EB Games and it was like luck of the draw which ones we get. I remember we got the Scarface game and that was actually pretty good. But I'm sure if I looked it up now, the rate, like it would be like a 2 stars or something. But at the time I was like, hell yeah, let's go.
That seems to be another common thing. Like, and it's especially for me as well. Like I ended up playing like Grand Theft Auto 3 when I was like 9 years old, and my parents had come back from Thailand with like those like fake, obviously copies of like PS2 games and stuff that you'd pick up at markets in like, you know, Phuket or, you know, Singapore or whatever. And we were lucky enough to have a modded PS2. So it was just like if you went to like Blockbuster or Video Easy or whatever and you borrowed out a game, you could just rip it to a DVD burner on your PC and just like, yeah, you've got that game to keep now. So
you're limitless. It's almost too much.
It was, yeah, the power kind of got to me, I will admit.
Yeah. Yeah.
It certainly wasn't great for, you know, a young kid's work ethic and work habits when you could just be like, I want to get that game and that game, and I could just be like, yeah, sure, it's all easy. So
I remember GTA 5 came out literally the month of my like year 12 exams.
Oh my god.
And I remember being like I have to resist the bounty, like this temptress, this siren in the sea, but I literally couldn't. I got it and I ripped through it and I don't regret it for a second. And now I own a game studio, so take from that what you will.
I think there's dedication to the craft, I think. It's,
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Can't read, can't write, but look at me now.
You've focused on the important things, I think, is what exactly. What matters. But exactly. Yeah, you'd sort of kept with the PlayStation sort of loyalty, I guess, throughout the sort of the PlayStation 1 and 2, and you sort of mentioned the 3 mm-hmm. as well. Did that sort of continue into like the PlayStation 4 and maybe even the 5 now? Is that sort of loyalty still there?
I've got them all. I'm such a loyalist. I think now my loyalty is truly to, PlayStation and Naughty Dog as well. Anything they put out, I'm gobbling up immediately. Actually, I was recently played Alan Wake as well, which is not Naughty Dog. And all I was right, like, you know what? There are some other studios out there that I should give a crack. but no, I'm every day I'm doing The Last of Us No Return. Daily run.
Yeah.
Do you do those?
I have not, but I played both part 1 and 2. Like incredible games.
Yeah, they're so good. I'd really recommend No Return. It's just a good time and like super addicting as well. I think you can get it if you've downloaded like Last of Us Part 2. You can get it for like $20 or something. Get it all remastered. Anyway, up to you. But I'd recommend it.
I think I have the game on PS5 and I've just like, I don't know, the game is so traumatic that it's just like I don't know if I want to like go back and deal with that again. So
I totally understand that. I remember playing Last of Us 2 when it first came out, and do you remember it was like delayed many times?
Mm-hmm.
And then it got like leaked and I think delayed again. But yeah, playing it in COVID, headphones on, blinds down, and gosh, it's like how many hours is Part 2?
It's a long one. It's definitely like almost or even like double the first one. It would have been sort of a good like 20 to 30 hours, I would say.
Yeah, too long to be in that world. Yeah. And like, but I think everyone did, and it was like, you need breaks from it, even though it's like a game of leisure. It's meant to be a fun hobby that we have, but it was truly like, oh Jesus fucking Christ, you have to take a little break. But it's so amazing.
You definitely hit the nail on the head when you sort of mentioned like headphones in, blinds down, like just
The
tunnel vision yourself towards the game, and that's it. And it was like, that was one of the first times in a while where I'd sort of done that. More often than not, when I'm playing games, I'm just like, oh yeah, you know, lights on and whatnot, and just playing it like the day is progressing as normal. But it's like, that was one that I'd been waiting for so long, just sort of sit there and shut everything out. And it's like, my focus is completely on that game. And in hindsight, that was probably a bad idea, because focusing on that game for too long made me really upset.
Yeah, it's pretty intense. Did you do it with Alan Wake?
No. So Alan Wake, like, I don't know why The Last of Us 2 is okay, but Alan Wake 2, like, I'm terrible with horror. I absolutely despise horror, and that's because I'm just a huge wuss. not through any other, like, you know, I'm not a huge fan of the medium, let's just say that.
That's fair.
All I've heard about Alan Wake 2 is that it is phenomenal, and even what they did before that, like, I loved Control. I loved what they did with that and sort of the way that they sort of utilized storytelling, and even further back with Quantum Break and how they were sort of utilizing, I guess, like live action. It was almost like a TV show within a video game, and that was sort of like, oh wow, that's kind of cool. So the way that Yeah, the way that they were sort of just like utilizing different ways of telling a story was just such a unique thing for me, sort of getting to grips with storytelling and games in general. So yeah, I'd loved that.
Yeah, it's so incredible. But I completely understand what you're saying about the horror. I'm also a big wuss, but I would like grit my teeth through the horror to enjoy that like storytelling that you were just talking about of like, oh, this is the price, is like me occasionally getting scared out of my mind and doing that like jolt jump scare that happens. I'm just like, oh, fucking hell, I'm truly in distress, like a trauma response. And you get back into the game and be like, okay, it's actually gorgeous and no one's doing it like this. I'll put up with it. But if you get scared, then it's not the game for you.
Okay. Like I think my biggest issue is more or less just the, like the jump scares are fine, but it's the nightmares afterwards that I find are the most troubling. Yes. So that can be difficult to sort of shake. So I'll definitely have to, keep the lights on when I play that one for sure.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Put a podcast on at the same time. Like really, really like pad the experience.
Just tune out as much as possible.
Tune out. In a game where
Oh man, in a game where you really need to be sort of focused in and sort of keeping an eye on what's going on, playing a podcast and keeping your lights on kind of counteracts the whole experience. So
yes, for a deeply immersive medium, perhaps the most immersive there is, I think that's the way to do it.
Exactly, yeah. What else have you been up to and playing? Like obviously Last of Us 2 and Alan Wake, like huge games. Is there anything that sort of has been taking your fancy that's a little bit more, I guess, on the indie side of things? Obviously, as an indie developer now yourself, are you sort of like scoping out certain things to get more of a more inspiration or sort of seeing what else is out there?
Oh, absolutely. I was definitely not like indie literate before starting my own like game dev journey. But Goose Game, definitely across that. I think it's amazing. Unpacking, incredible as well. Have you played Nidhogg?
I have, a very long time
ago.
Oh,
it's so good.
It's wild.
Yeah, so that's one that me and my partner, we got obsessed with a few months ago. It's incredible. It's like, it's the most simple game I think I've ever played, but it's the most addicting. For those who don't know, you just play a kind of pixelated fencer and playing against, like it's a two-player game playing against someone else who's like fencing you back. And you're jumping all over the place, you're stabbing each other, and this like intense like rock soundtrack's playing. It's the coolest ever. I'd highly recommend it.
Yeah, it's sort of like a little jousting session, isn't it? A little sort of like...
Hell yeah.
Little duel, yeah. It's very simple, I think, yeah, graphic-wise. But for those sorts of games, like gameplay alone is purely all that you need. And I think something like that is so... just 100 miles a minute sort of action, I think like that's perfect for it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. But I do need to like just in general get more across the indie space. I've definitely got more in it than I was, but it's like a bottomless well. So yeah, definitely something I need to do.
Yeah, I think as a you know, a new indie developer yourself, you need to be across everything and sort of seeing what people are doing. But I think like I'm just really sort of excited for you to see, you know, what happens with My Arms Are Longer now. Like having seen the sort of test footage and how that sort of plays in an actual sort of like gaming sense, and sort of bringing your art as well into something that is not particularly sort of like a normal medium for you, I think is very, very exciting.
For sure, yeah. I think like across... you know, animation or comics or, you know, web series or whatever, the art style and the comedic voice does like crossover, which is where I have found like a bit of safety and comfort of like, yeah, I can't explain to you what Unity does, or if I look at it, I feel a bit sick, to be honest. But in terms of like writing the jokes and doing the art, while like the technical side of it is like definitely something to wrap your head around, the kind of the voice coming through is like still, it's always like a touchstone of like, no, like Vic Screen and Screen Oz know that it's me and I can get a little freaky with it. But yeah, it's yeah, it's crazy.
They leave you to your own devices, don't they? They let you just be like, oh, free reign with it.
they really leave you to your own devices and they trust you a lot. They give you a lot of opportunity and they're kind of like your biggest cheerleader. In Melbourne especially, we're so lucky. Gubbins is another game that's wonderful as well from Melbourne.
Hey, I mean, like you sort of mentioned the comedy aspect of games, and last episode we had Ben Russell on the show to talk
yes,
about
yes, I listened.
Game. Oh, well, thank you.
Of course.
He sort of mentioned the companies sort of not utilizing comedy correctly or sort of just not utilizing it at all when, you know, there's opportunities to bring, you know, even comedians in to help write scripts or write sort of certain jokes and things.
Oh, big
time. How are you finding the sort of background that you've got with, you know, obviously acting and comedy, and how are you finding sort of translating that into a medium like a video game?
I think it is like a nice safety net of like, hey, at the end of the day, I can't code, but there is a skill set that I do feel comfortable in. The voice, like I was saying, it does translate across, and I totally agree with what Ben was saying about, especially, this might be controversial, but games writing in general, sometimes you'll be listening to like some dialogue and you're like, oof, get a screenwriter in, not even a comedy writer, but I feel like sometimes designers step in as writers or something like that, or it's people who are cross-pollinating from a tech side, and it can really let a game down, unfortunately. Like, I really loved It Takes Two, the like co-op a game. I think it's from a French studio, but the dialogue in it and the story was like so strange, and even I was watching my partner Matt play. The reason I keep saying my partner is because you're called Matt, and so I'm not yes. just being like I have a boyfriend bragging every time. My partner, he's playing Dragon's Dogma right now, and it's just the clunkiest like
yes,
dialogue of the NPCs you could possibly imagine. I just feel like it's something that's so worth investing in. And when you do, you get wonderful games like The Last of Us, like Alan Wake, where it's like the story is just as rich. But I think Melbourne in particular has a great comedy indie scene where like the two marry really wonderfully.
I think that's a good point, that it's you know, Melbourne's style of comedy and sort of that culture of comedy sort of intersecting quite well. And I think you do tend to see more of those sorts of, I don't want to say bizarre because they are kind of, but it's the sort of off-kilter sort of like, those sorts of style of games that you wouldn't expect. Like you mentioned, like Gubbins being this, you know, absolutely bizarre word game and sort of being this unique experience being utilized for what was essentially like Scrabble, essentially, like all these weird powers and things. And it's just that sort of sense of Melbourne's got like that sort of sense of humor almost, and they're sort of applying it into its games that are being created. And I think more cities and more sort of just, you know, studios in general need to be sort of utilizing that humor. And I think, you know, you get better sort of results out of it if you are sort of tapping into the comedy scene and sort of making sure that it's people who know comedy or understand comedy who are helping
totally.
Out. And it's not just as Ben Russell said, like suits behind a desk thinking that they're, you know, the next class clown and trying to write up all of these jokes that just absolutely don't stick. So there's definitely a sort of like a level where you, or sort of like a middle ground that you need to try and reach, which can be difficult. So I can understand that the issues of trying to make certain things land can be quite difficult. So I can definitely appreciate the work you're putting in.
Oh, for sure. Oh, thank you so much. So, like essential worker. It's very important work.
I will do it. I'll salute you for that. Yes.
Thank you so much. Did you play Days Gone?
I did, yes.
I think that's a perfect example of, like such a strong, like I really love the hordes and the zombies and like running around on the motorbike was like so awesome. But the narrative and the dialogue was just so stinky, in my opinion.
I kind of feel the same way. I hate to keep bringing it back up, but like Borderlands is the perfect example of a game that plays really well, but the writing and the humor and just the tone of voice on it, it just feels so like cookie cutter cardboard and very just like not funny. Like it's a lot of toilet humor, and it was almost like the Rick and Morty before Rick and Morty.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. yeah, it's hard to get right. I do wonder why that's not being prioritized. I guess, like, at the end of the day, the actual gameplay and game design and mechanics is, you know, top of mind for everyone. But, yeah, at studios like Naughty Dog, where it's the narrative is just as important, if not more, it shines through. Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect way to move into our next sort of period of the show. And, of course, as part of the show, we get the guest to talk about a game that they feel has influenced either their personal life or their career. Millie, what game have you chosen for us?
I have picked Sly 2 Band of Thieves.
Oof, a classic. Oof. It's a game that I guess... when you sort of think about of like the classics of the PS2 era, I feel like it's a game that kind of doesn't get enough credit. Like, and the reviews,
I'm with you.
The reviews for it are all like, you know, 9 out of 10, 90% sort of thing, and like really high up there, critically acclaimed. But it's like no one ever seems to sort of talk about it or think about it unless you are really sort of digging deep. Like, you've got your Jack and Daxters, you've got your Ratchet and Clanks, which, funnily enough, we're all around the same sort of time period. And then there's Sly Cooper, like, and no one seems to really be talking about that. So it's bizarre how this game, which by all accounts was critically acclaimed and sold fairly well, just like no one seems to remember it.
Yeah, it's crazy. And you're so right. Like, I think growing up, I put it on the same, like, well, it must be as popular as Jack and Daxter, Ratchet and Clank, which I also loved. And or even like Crash Bandicoot, Spyro. Like, I was playing Sly Cooper number 2 and 3, not so much 1, we'll talk about that later, but 2 and 3 in particular, like, on repeat. Like, I was rewatching a playthrough right before this just so I could like refresh my memory of the certain aspects of it, and I knew like the background music off by heart. I knew the lines off by heart. It's just it's embedded in my brain. So I'm always fascinated that, like, I'm honestly, it's such a relief that you know it, because whenever I bring it up to people, like, you know, and Sly Cooper, I'm met with silence. I have to explain the plot of Sly Cooper.
I mean, what's not to get? It's Sly Cooper, a thief raccoon. Like, it's
yes,
it's perfect. I think
it's perfect.
That sort of time period of like, yeah, we're all just gonna have like anthropomorphic animal mascots, and like, Sony, for whatever, you know, reason, like, after the original Crash trilogy, like, they're obviously like, yeah, we need a new mascot. Like, you have 3 there and you couldn't really decide on one.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you're so right that, like, Sly is very ratchety. And I guess kind of Jackie as well. Like, they all have that, well, Jack and... once he gets his voice, they have that little a bit of spunk to him. But these like little fellas,
yeah, and that sort of obviously predates the whole like Nathan Drake like smart talking asshole sort of character. And like, I felt like they all kind of had that in a little way. So it's they were obviously trying to find a type of mascot, and for whatever reason, it clearly didn't stick, which was weird. But I mean, like, I haven't played this game in a very, very long time, but, and I'm the same as you, like, I looked up a walkthrough just to sort of, you know, get reacquainted with the game and how it plays. Like, this game is so much fun.
Oh, it's so good. It's so good. Should we explain what the deal is for the people who might not know? Because I feel like it is... we're very special in that we've played it. Look, how do you even surmise this game, Matt? It's so you play as Sly. You are a raccoon who is also a master thief. Your family is from a lineage of thieves, but they're murdered when you're but a little raccoon by Clockwork, who is a big bird. And I guess gameplay wise, it is, you know what, I think it's very Assassin's Creed, pre-Assassin's Creed. You're jumping around on rooftops, you're pickpocketing, and in the second one it gets extra special because your friends Murray and Bentley are playable, and Murray is the muscle, and so sometimes you'll do missions where you have to, you know, bash people up or break through things, and Bentley is the tech head, so you'll sometimes have to do a mini game where you hack computers. And they have this beautiful, like, familial relationship, and it's just a wonderful time.
I think you basically summed that up perfectly. I couldn't have done any better myself.
And I couldn't have done it without going into the backstory of Sly, which I felt was very necessary.
Yes, it was.
A tragic story.
I think we kind of forgot to mention that they do go around in a van, very Scooby-Doo-like. Yes. So,
yes, around the world they'll go to all different places collecting treasures, and one big treasure, there's one big score, and let's not forget Carmelita Fox, who is the detective chasing after them in a very cat and mouse, will they, won't they, with Sly, because there's a beautiful tension there as well.
There is. I'm just like, yeah, come on, guys. Like, just kiss and make up, clearly.
Oh, my God. It's so good. And the third... I'm starting to ramble because I'm just having all these, like, core memories pop up. Did you play the third one as well?
Only very briefly.
That's very fair. There's a level where they go to Australia, and it's really cool.
Ah, so it's not at all stereotypical.
Yeah, no. They go to Australia, and, well, they are in the outback, there are dingoes everywhere, and at one point Murray has a drinking contest to win favour with the miners.
That's so amazing. I love that.
So good.
I feel like every game in the mid-2000s that involved Australia was like the most stereotypical, just like clear-cut parody of what Australians were. And I think like times have changed, obviously, and people sort of do look at us a little bit more respectfully, but it's always a lot of fun seeing how people saw us in other parts of the world. But
it's very humbling.
Exactly. Question I wanted to ask, did I guess Sly sort of like being stealthy and sort of obviously there's a big heist in this game, were you inspired for My Arms Are Longer Now by any sort of Sly like aesthetic? It clearly seems like there's a link there.
You know what? I only realized the link but today as I was like rewatching Sly. I was like, it was like a real wow moment sitting by myself of like, oh, Matt Tilby has awakened something of like, oh my God, I can't believe but I did not realize it. I think I've always loved heist movies and like heists in general, and that was definitely the inspiration behind My Arms Are Longer Now, but I never drew that original like love of oceans, like those sort of movies, like as being the origin. Like the origin of that is absolutely Sly Cooper, and I never realized it. You are responsible for that. So yeah, thank you for helping me realize that. But yeah, Sly's responsible for My Arms Are Longer Now.
We've got a scoop, ladies and gentlemen. I'm so proud.
You've got a scoop.
But I mean, you did mention the sort of Assassin's Creed pre-Assassin's Creed thing, and I think it makes perfect sense. I think the whole sort of like balancing on wires and sort of using your cane to sort of like sneak coins out of pockets of enemies behind you. Like when you get to games like Metal Gear Solid, where stealth is the only answer and it's like super realistic and not super realistic, you're walking around in a fucking cardboard box, but the way that this game makes stealth fun, I think was such a big thing for me.
So cool. And they're like, there's also like trailing missions and like following missions as well, where it's look, I wouldn't be surprised if Ubisoft saw Assassin's Creed. No, sorry, saw Sly Cooper and were like, let's make this for adults, because it's like kind of a, I know that's a crazy claim just for the record, but it's kind of, it's so much like overlap. It's and the climbing in Sly Cooper as well, with your hook, like going up these buildings, like it's so much fun. And definitely, I can't believe that it didn't get more flowers at the time, like the worlds that were built. And but it is like absolutely a game for kids at the same time, but it's like so well done and rich. And even like the sound design of like when you're creeping up on someone, there's this beautiful, like very orchestral kind of camp. Like it's, everything's a bit over the top. It goes like doop, 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 doop,
yeah,
doop, as you get closer. And yeah, it's just like, it's a whole bunch of fun. It makes like, yeah, stealth just like such a joy. And as a kid as well, I would get petrified of them seeing me, because especially there's a level where you go to like Transylvania, sort of like this spooky kind of horror world. And the creatures that are chasing you there are very, very spooky. So I remember that level taking a little while for me to get through. But it was so much fun.
Yeah, I think the sort of exaggerated sort of art style, keeping that very sort of
kid
friendly, but also very like expressive. And I think, you know, it's even some of like the first couple of missions and sort of the environments in the level, like just running over rooftops and you know, like awnings and stuff, like it, I think that's it. Like, it just made stealth fun. I think that was the perfect,
for sure,
the perfect thing for, you know, even for someone like myself who'd played it, you know, many years ago, when I remember playing the demo for Metal Gear Solid 2 at the same, around the same time, I should say, and being so frustrated that, like, oh, I'm, you know, taking out someone silently, and then like the alarm goes off and it all just, you know, goes pear-shaped. Like, there's a lot more sort of leeway to this game and being able to sneak past people or take people out, and just sort of, there's not as, I guess, not as much of a consequence if you are found, which is great.
Yeah, just a bit of a jump scare when you're 11 years old. Very scary stuff, actually. From memory, the combat was also really fun. Like, you know, for like all the characters. Spoiler alert, in number 3, Bentley is in a wheelchair for the whole thing. And even the wheelchair, you can do like spin attacks. And the ending of 2 is truly tragic. But we'll get to that later, maybe. Well, I'll just say it. Like, Bentley Bentley the turtle gets paralyzed because, like, the big kind of monster falls on him. And Murray the big hippo has to, like, carry him away. And they kind of decide to, like, not be in the gang anymore. And Sly Cooper has to run away. It's, like, a very sad, like, they've beat the bad guy, but the group has to disperse. And, like, the arc of the whole story is, like, so wonderfully told, and it's like funny as well the whole time. And yeah, but when he comes back, of course the gang comes back together, and Bentley's wheelchair has so many gadgets, and it's really cool.
it's a sort of like I've won but at what cost trope, which I think is great, but
it's so good.
And you sort of mentioned like the humor and sort of the, and even the voice acting as well, like Bentley sort of being voiced as this very stereotypical, like, nasally nerd with big, thick-rimmed glasses, and, oh, man, and Murray sort of being, like, almost like a superhero or trying to be a superhero.
Oh,
like,
yeah. This, like, lovable, dumb oaf is, but he's so good. And they all, like, have such care for each other as well. It's very sweet.
Yeah. I thought for the longest time, like, especially the last week or so when I was going back through the game, I thought for sure that the voice actor for Sly was actually the guy who did the voices for Spider-Man in the new, the newest Spider-Man game, but it isn't. I was like, that sounds eerily close to Yuri Lowenthal, who did, who's done like everything in terms of voice acting, like Spider-Man. He was in Persona 5 and like a bunch of other games, but it, for whatever reason, it wasn't him, which I was surprised about, but.
Yeah, it's very, like, in that Spider-Man vein, like, it's very all-American, like, like sardonic, a little bit sarcastic, but Sly's the cool one, and we don't forget it. He's a very cool guy.
He is very cool. I guess to sort of, like, wrap it all up and sort of bring it full circle, we did obviously mention the fact that we now have a link for Sly 2 to My Arms Are Longer Now, but in general, what would you say is sort of the influence that Sly has had on either your personal life or your career? What was that sort of link for you?
Oh, that's such a good question. I would say, like, Sly was probably the first narrative game, that, like, proper narrative game that I would have played. I think maybe Crash Bandicoot, they have their own, like, kind of sprinkle of it, but, like, the character development and relationships in Sly are so integral to it. And so that definitely, like, gave it its replay value for me, and kind of definitely, like, fostered that love of narrative games that I have. And to an extent, I remember when I was I took some time off after high school because I didn't know what I wanted to do, and I was too scared to go to, like, VCA or apply for a writing school. And so I went to, I did 4 days of marketing at RMIT, and then I dropped out because I was so sad and I realized that I was paying for this. And then I, you know, took some time off. And I remember when I was, like, trying to convince myself to do screenwriting at VCA, and I was like, I remember writing myself, like, it's very lame, but like a little letter. And in the letter there was like I was listing kind of shows that I loved and how like maybe one day I could write something like that if I went to VCA. And in there was also games that I loved. And I don't think I listed Sly, but just the fact that like, I think Uncharted was maybe in there, maybe Last of Us was in there.
Mm.
But in terms of like, I wouldn't be enjoying those games if I hadn't enjoyed Sly. Like, for me, the trail to them is like super clear. There's like narrative, like big kind of blockbuster romps.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, and while it like took a while, and once I started uni, I was like, oh, it looks like games, like I kind of forgot the dream of writing for games. It's nice that, yeah, it's kind of, I've come back to that and been like, oh my gosh, this was like something I originally really wanted to do. And yeah, without Sly, I absolutely wouldn't have probably made the choice to pursue that in the first place.
Yeah, for sure. And I can definitely sort of see, would you say that there's like I was going to say the genesis of sort of like your style of humor. Like, there's a lot of like very zany, very wacky sort of humor in a game like Sly 2, where it's like, you know, it's not supposed to be overtly slapstick and sort of that sort of style of humor, but it clearly seems like that sort of influenced your sense of humor or your style of humor that you are now sort of utilizing in things like Longhead and sort of even your comedy shows and sort of your podcast. Like, it clearly has brought that sense of humor forward for you.
Oh, absolutely. I think something that Sly does really well is, like, it plays on the heist parody really well. Like, it's definitely leaning into the tropes of it, but at times it does undercut it because it is for kids. And in terms of my comedy, like leading with a genre trope and then undercutting it, I think is genuinely 80% of my work, if not 90, if not 100. like genre moment, just kidding. And I'm almost reluctant to say, to break it down so simply, because now I feel like once I've said it, people be like, wait a sec. That's all she fucking does. But it is all I do. It's this genre, but not really. And I think, yeah, that kind of, that style of humor is definitely like in Sly, and probably was the first instance that I ingested of it. And also what you're saying of like the characters, I don't know if in your rewatch you came across Dimitri the Lizard in Sly Cooper. Oh, on the rewatch, I forgot about that fellow and I was slapping my knee laughing at that lizard. He's like, for those who don't know, he's like a lizard in Paris and he runs a nightclub and he makes counterfeit money and we're trying to steal something from him. But he also has these like kind of one-liners like a video game character would have. What nationality is he? He's kind of like Eastern European-y, like...
Yeah, I think so. I can't remember.
But he's always saying stuff like, yeah, party time. Like, he's just kind of out of nowhere saying these strange lines. And he's such a kooky character, and it's so great that the writers on Sly were able to, like, make him so weird. So, yes, is the short answer. There's absolutely a link there.
Yeah, I think it's a perfect sort of encapsulation of both the narrative aspects that you really enjoy, as well as the comedy that you really enjoy as well. So I think it's a really good answer to a great game, and I think everyone should find a way to pick this up and play it, because
it's not too late.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Like, it's not too late, and it's definitely a game that, as we sort of said earlier, like, kind of flew under the radar for a lot of people, but is definitely well worth the time.
Yeah, and if you can't be bothered playing it, just ring me up and I'll explain the plot beat by beat like I have done tonight, because I reckon I only scratched the surface of the wonderful plot that is Sly 2 and 3. And you haven't even heard about when Bentley gets a girlfriend. So give me a call, I'll let you know.
I can't wait. It's going to be so much fun. But Millie, I guess that's sort of the end of the show for now. Is there anywhere that you would like people to be directed to? Is there any sort of social accounts people would want to follow?
Yeah, I reckon I'm most active on Instagram, so at Millie Holton, and that's where you'll find me. Thank you so much.
No, of course. It's been a huge pleasure to have you on, and I guess people should definitely go and watch the little skits that you've put out recently, which have been very fun with alongside Ashley Appap and the sleeper agent one, sort of.
Oh yes, with Josh Chodzisner. Yes.
The perfect encapsulation of your sort of tropes and then sort of like going underneath it. I think that's the perfect encapsulation of that. So definitely need to go and have a watch of that if you haven't seen that already on her Instagram. And of course,
oh, thank you.
You can also go and find my socials and OPG at OPGpod on Twitter. And you can also follow me at It's Tilby. But yes, that is it for another episode of One Perfect Game. And from me, Matt Tilby, and my very special guest, Millie Holton, it is goodbye for now. Take care.
Hey, we're back.
Oh, we're back, yes.
We're back. I had to get Matt to turn on his recording again because I need to let you know on the record, you're as good as Sean Evans.
Yes. Validation.
I couldn't go without letting you know. I had to say it. We hung up. I was like, no, there was something I had to say. All right. Goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye, everyone.